Dropped a few papers.
Oh, dear.
They're just doing cousin.
Yeah.
And you have families that can just make that one.
Yes.
Yes, they do.
Okay, so that we can start on time. I want to welcome you to this session. I'm going to change the name a little bit. It's supposed to be, the name of the session is supposed to be Science and Technology. I'm going to put my glasses on. Serving Humanity. I think we can call it Service and Disservice to Humanity, and that will balance out our two talks. Our first talk is by Christopher Cowell. Am I pronouncing that right? He's a grad student at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon, grad student in computer science, and his talk is titled Artificial Creatures and Alternate Creations, Framing the Conversation About Virtual Reality and Robotics.
Thank you. All right, so yes, my talk today is essentially going to pertain to virtual reality and robotics, and the ethics concerning those, specifically the Christian ethics of these two topics. And I also want to mention that it's essentially going to be talking about reality and fantasy and how we approach these technologies in light of reality and fantasy and how they're sort of reframing our understanding of what this is. That's going to make more sense in a bit. So I'm a computer scientist, and for the past couple years, I've been very interested in virtual reality myself. And then now that I'm at Oregon State, I met someone there, Matthew Rubin, my co-conspirator on this presentation, putting it together. And we got talking about our individual disciplines, his being robotics, specifically the ethics we've been having, the ethics we've been thinking about for these topics, and from a Christian perspective, as that's the perspective we both come from. And we noticed something very interesting as we would talk about robotics and virtual reality and the ethics pertaining to them, in that they share many resemblances with each other. Usually you don't see in the literature people talking about robotics and virtual reality in context with each other, but they share many questions and concerns when it comes to the ethics pertaining to them. So we wanted to make a presentation of some sort addressing them in context with each other to help us understand them and frame it correctly, as well as do it from a Christian perspective, as the literature is very thin on that as well. So many of us have a few ideas of ethical concerns when it comes to robotics and or virtual reality. A few of them would be like robots taking jobs in the workplace. Maybe a bit more of an extreme one was robots taking over society, either by force or just societally. I hear that talked about in academia as well as pop culture. And then for virtual reality, we see things like VR addiction, cyberbullying in virtual reality, and so on and so forth, and as well as virtual reality taking over society in like a Ready Player One sort of style. I'm going to say right now that I don't have time to go and pick all of these and address them from an ethical and a Christian perspective. Instead, I kind of want to be able to start the conversation on such issues. You may see some of these themes coming up through my talk. I'm not going to address all of them particularly specifically, though. I hope that when people walk away from this, they now have a better understanding of the technologies and a better understanding of how to approach these topics from a Christian perspective. So, first of all, I want to start off with a couple definitions for both of these technologies. And these definitions are fairly informal. They're picked and put together based on the literature we, Matthew Rubin and I, have looked through, and a lot of what he's talked to me about. He's the roboticist here, and so I've pulled from him heavily on the robot side of this. But first of all, let's go with these definitions. They may be incomplete, but they're good at framing the conversation from an ethics perspective. So first of all, a good definition of a robot is a human-made, reprogrammable, and physical device which senses, processes what it senses, then acts after processing. Now that last bit, senses, processes what it senses, then acts after processing, I'm not going to go into heavily here. That's more of a general definition of artificial intelligence, which isn't the topic here. Instead, I want to highlight that section in orange. So a robot is human-made, which right off the bat tells us that humans are not robots, animals and plants are not robots, but a robot must be artificially created by humans. But they're reprogrammable, which tells us two things. On one extreme, a robot is more than just a machine. It's more than a conveyor belt or a car, which serves one purpose and is designed for that. But a robot could be repurposed for different jobs and is capable of interacting in its environment in dynamic ways. And on the other end, it tells us that a robot is less than a sentient being. Count me among the people who don't consider robots to have souls, and that robots are not equal to humans on this earth, but that robots are without the will that a human has because they are programmed and reprogrammable by humans. And then that final point I want to mention is that they're a physical device. Basically, this is to distinguish them from AI. A robot may be controlled or have an AI, an artificial intelligence, within it, but they're not the same thing. A robot is a physical device or object within the physical world and can interact physically within that environment. Also, a side note worth mentioning that may not be fully captured in this definition is that just because something looks and acts very, very human does not mean it's a robot or that the ethics around it is a robot question. I mention this because there's a lot of companies out there and research that's trying to make robots humanoid, trying to make them very human-like and lifelike. And for a lot of people and for media can go wild when this happens, talking about, oh, what does this mean? How is the modern robot going to affect the world? And I want us to be careful because not everything that is designed to look and act human is necessarily going to fit a definition like this or a definition you may see in the literature. It's a different topic altogether. And I mention that because I will be talking about human-robot interaction specifically in like a personal way later on. And I just want to pinpoint that human-robot interaction is just a subset of robotics. You can have a robot that looks completely different than humans. And then going on real quick, we got the virtual reality definition, which is any human-made, non-physical, spatial environment which allows for the simultaneous presence of multiple individuals. So let me check my time real quick. So first of all, you see human-made, similar to robots. Non-physical, which is the opposite of what I said about a robot. A robot was physical. A virtual reality is virtual. It's non-physical. So first of all, you can see that this is a bit different from telepresence. It bears many similarities to telepresence, but telepresence is the communication within the physical world via technology, and this is non-physical. And it also means stuff like Disney World, where we're creating environments and worlds that are like fake, is not a virtual reality. It's still within this physical world. That spatial environment part, I'm not going to go into great depth here because I don't have enough time to go into it, but basically that's to rule out things like text messaging apps and email applications where the language in like human-computer action in that field may talk about environments, the environment of the text message app. But when we're talking about virtual reality, when we say environment, we mean it in much the same way when we're talking about a physical environment where you've got a location and other things have a location within this environment. And then this last bit is a little different than what you'll see in much of the academic community. The simultaneous presence of multiple individuals, I feel like, is a necessary component if we're going to be talking about the unique ethics pertaining to virtual reality. This distinguishes things like just playing Mario on a Game Boy or Pokemon, like a Pokemon game all by yourself. Whereas if you're in a virtual environment with other humans communicating, maybe in an MMO or through an Oculus Rift headset, where you're communicating in this environment with other people, this raises the ethical concerns that many people have for virtual reality. And so this is what distinguishes it from just another game. I feel like intercommunication within this world is a huge part of what makes reality significant and is a huge part of what makes our Christian beliefs significant. And so it's worth mentioning that a virtual reality is only considered to be a virtual reality if it has this component. So now I want to go into talking about virtual reality in the context of reality. I mentioned that I was going to be talking about reality and fantasy a good bit here, so let's go up with this great scholastic resource on the topic, the Oxford Dictionary, that does, I think, just a really good in plain language way of distinguishing what reality is and what fantasy is. So fantasy is something that is produced by the imagination, whereas reality is something that exists independently from the mind. This is not novel or anything. I think it just lays the groundwork for what we're talking about. Fantasy is something that is produced by the imagination. It's like when you're reading a book and you're imagining the world in the book. It's unique to you, and someone else may be reading the book at the same time or listening to it read to them at the same time. But ultimately, what the world is in their mind is different than yours. You can see that this is a fantasy, not a reality, based on things that aren't mentioned directly in the book. Like if there's a wardrobe in the room over, and it's not mentioned, it's only mentioned, but it's not mentioned what size it is or anything, for example. You may think of it as a great big 15-foot wardrobe. Someone else may think of it as a very small 6-foot wardrobe. But ultimately, there's no ultimate truth in that story. It hasn't been mentioned, and so you've created two different imaginary universes. You can't measure the wardrobe. It was just mentioned. It was never completed. It's completed in the individual's mind. Whereas in a real world with a real wardrobe, it actually has truths associated with it. You don't just end a conversation with someone who disagrees with you on the size of it by saying, "Ah, oh, that's your reality, this is my reality, it's different." You can actually go and measure that and find the actual facts about that physical, that actual real wardrobe. And such is the case in a virtual environment, a virtual reality. A virtual wardrobe in the other room, to carry this example further, has these facts pertaining to it, has this truth associated with it that can be measured and that is not individual-based. It's a shared reality among all individuals within that environment. So that's why I'm talking about virtual reality as more than just like a game or just an imagination, why I'm ascribing it much of the similarities we ascribe to physical reality. Now this could arise like some weird ways of lining up different realities. The second we start talking about different realities, how are we going to categorize those? You could say like there's a spiritual reality, and then there's a physical reality, and then there's virtual realities. You wouldn't really have any great groundwork or basis to be able to make such claims, neither scientifically or biblically. I can't think of any reasons to just label it like that. I think a better way of understanding what I'm talking about with this is to have this concept of primary reality, which is mentioned a bit in the literature. Primary reality, in the context of what I'm talking about, is basically this capital T truth, this ultimate truth that exists everywhere. In this example, it would be like God and his laws and God's nature would be part of primary reality that is existent in physical reality and virtual reality. This is not just a side note to box God into something that's greater than him. This is just a way of categorizing what we're talking about here. Ultimately, this concept of primary reality means that if we're going to go into a virtual world, that existence is still there. Much like when the Pevensies go into Narnia, God is still there. It's not that he followed them into the wardrobe. He's still there. So when we go into a virtual world with other people, God is still there, his laws are still there, and his mission is still there. This may seem obvious. It's like, okay, if I'm playing a video game or if I'm at work in a training scenario, I can still pray to God and he's listening to me. But it's more than that. It's not just that we can still communicate to God, but our actions within that reality, within that world, still have real significance on the people we interact with within that world. I want to go into that a lot more, but I'm going to move on to a little segment I want to talk about for robotics. And in this context, I want to be talking about robotics in the context of fantasy on the other end. Now, I have mentioned that robots are real, they're physical within this world, but there's a certain level of fantasy that's associated with them that I think needs addressing, that comes up in some of the ethical concerns we talk about. So I mentioned fantasy is something that is produced by the imagination. It's not something, as opposed to reality, which is shared by all of us. And is existent beyond us. But I did mention that robots are not fantasy, they're real, right? So what is this fantasy I'm talking about? The fantasy, think of it this way, so the robot would be in comparison to the book in the previous example, or the words in the book. It incites the fantasy we have. So if we're having a friendship with a robot, maybe the experience is real, maybe the robot is real, but the friendship may be the fantasy. Let me explain that with an example. So imagine a few years in the future, a couple has a 6-year-old daughter, and she loves hanging out with her friends, but her best friend is the household robot in their house. And she enjoys the other kids, but she'd rather be with the robot. She considers the robot her best friend. Well, this concerns the parents, not because they believe that the robot is fake or that it's not real, nor that the experiences the daughter has with the robot are fake, but that she ascribes personage to the robot. And this concerns the parent. Now, this may seem a little far-fetched, but this is a concern for many people. What about, like, how are people communicating to their Alexa device and their Google Home device as a human? What if these become more able to communicate it to us like it's a person? Is this a concern? And in our example, maybe the parents are concerned that she's interacting with it too much. So it seems to be a well-founded concern, but I want to ask you, is it just because there's a fantasy associated with the human interaction with the robot, does this make it bad? We have fantasies in our world every day. We have books, we have movies, and we consider these fine. So I think it's worth considering what is the purpose of fantasy so that we can see if such a situation is it bad here. A fantasy's purpose, as far as what I can see in literature and what seems to make sense to me, is it tells us what should be or how we should view things in the real world. A fantasy is fiction, it's fake, it's not real, but it tells us how we should view things. To bring up the Narnian example, it's almost as if C.S. Lewis recognized that the attributes of God, his love and his power, are not always obvious to everyone all the time, and so he created this fantasy named Aslan to demonstrate God's power and God's love and other attributes in a way that is clear in a fiction world so that people reading about it can understand how they should view God, how they should view the real deity. Such is the example, is the truth, when we create other fantasies. And when we create robots to interact with people in a realistic way, we need to like ride this line in between the two extremes. The one extreme is viewing it as totally real, the experience to be completely like an interaction with a human, and that there's no difference. This would get into like robot ethics, as in robots have souls and everything. That's one extreme we need to avoid, but at the same time, we need to avoid just throwing out it as dangerous, the interaction as dangerous or unnecessary simply because it's a fantasy. There's value in the fantasy we create by having humanoid robots that we need to recognize the value there as well. So in the example of the girl and the robot, to round that off, let's say the girl believes she has hurt the robot in some way and she feels bad and apologizes. If this robot has been designed to express what should be, how the girl should view reality, it would accept the apology in a good way and demonstrate good Christian morals and principles to the 6-year-old girl, so that now she's experienced how a friendship should be, how she should forgive, how she should apologize when it comes to real human interactions. So I want to go into that a lot more. Obviously, I was kind of rushing. But I sort of want to close out with a few comments about this. So first of all, I want to mention something that I was hoping to get to earlier. I think I have enough time to say it. A big reason why we see similarities between robotics and virtual reality is that a robot is essentially an artificial creature within a physical world. And then the opposite is true for virtual reality. A virtual reality is an artificial world with physical creatures in it, with us in it. If you have just an artificial creature within an artificial world, you have something that's artificial. If you have the vice versa, a physical creature within a physical world, you have something that's a physical reality. But it's this hybrid between the two, this new concept that we have nowadays that's seeping into all parts of our society, that makes us ask these questions about reality and fantasy and how these are good and bad technologies. I want to round it off now with a couple comments. So these technologies, though, are not new throughout society. They are new to be so capable of what they can do nowadays that I can just have a virtual reality headset in my house, that I can have an Alexa device in my house. And so now is the time, I believe, for the church, the body of Christ, to take these technologies and see how we can use them for a good purpose, to define their purpose within society. They're currently technologies. How we're going to use them is the question. Are they going to be used simply for an industry tool, in the case of robotics, to be able to get ahead of the competition? In virtual reality, is it simply going to be a platform for game and a way to escape? Or instead, are these technologies going to be ways we can express our Christian beliefs throughout the world? And even in the case of virtual reality, get access to mission fields that were never possible before we had this new technology among us. Thank you.
I actually ended 1 minute early, so I can have questions.
Yes, we can have questions.
Yes.
We can have quite a few questions. First, you're first, but we can have a few more.
Thank you so much. Very good. What is your take on this comment that is common in my generation, mm-hmm. which is the generation ahead of you from whom you've descended? Mm-hmm. I hate that the kids are on the phone all the time. I require them not to have their phone in my class, and the big complaint is that we're losing socialization skills. And people are becoming just embedded in their devices. Could you just respond to that from your perspective as a Christian interested in applying technology for godly purposes?
Yeah, so I believe we are currently in a transitioning standpoint where our communication through technology is pretty rudimentary. Our level of the way we communicate as humans is like, I don't know how they measure this, but like 10% text. And then 90% other things like physical communication and inflection. And so I believe, I agree with much of that sentiment that is common in that when someone is sitting there nowadays with their smartphone, with their access to text messages and social media, they're no longer alone in the sense that we usually think of it. They have all these different responsibilities. They're communicating with all these different people throughout. And it is a pretty rudimentary and low-level form of communication as opposed to what they could be having with the people in front of them, with the people around them. I think with the advent of modern ways, modern immersive methods of virtual reality, we could see a trend towards a world where going and communicating with your friends or your family through a virtual experience is virtually indistinguishable from the benefits you would get from an actual physical in-person communication. But I don't think we're there yet. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you. You talked about the 6-year-old girl mm-hmm. interacting with a human-like robot. I really don't see that there's a lot of difference between that, except for the reality of that robot looks really real, and that could mislead the kid, but kids have always been attached to something. They have a stuffed animal or something that they can't live without, and if you left this stuffed animal at grandma and grandpa's house, you gotta drive back there and get it, or the kid's not gonna sleep. And I had a daughter who had an imaginary friend. Mm-hmm. Now, in that case, she knows it's imaginary, even though she'll act like it's real. I could see that there's a bit of a danger of a kid who might get attached to a human-like robot mm-hmm. and then be very disappointed that, oh, it's not real.
Yeah. Yeah, so that I'm glad you brought that up. That's something that Matt Rubin, the guy I've been working on with robotics, is very interested in. What is the difference between a lifelike robot and interacting with that and just other forms of, like, a stuffed animal or something like that? Yes. And so from what I've understood from child psychology, I don't know what the age is, but up to a certain age, a child has a hard time distinguishing between what is real and what is fake. And so to a child, there can be very little difference between the stuffed animal being alive and the dog or even the person. And so I would say, and I'm kind of thinking on my feet here, I would say that there is huge similarities between the daughter, the girl having a friendship with the robot, and the girl having a friendship with her stuffed animal. I guess the difference would be in that it's just a level of realism, and it may take her longer to figure it out on her own if she weren't told that there is a difference between the robot and human. But I kind of feed off of that sentiment, why I'm not really terrified at the idea of kids interacting with robots, because they've been doing similar things for a while. I think the main issue is to make sure that the interactions with the robots is something healthy and not something detrimental.
Yes, next.
Yeah, just springing off of that too, Sherry Turkle's written a lot about this in Alone Together, but half the book is about robot interactions and social robotics. She talks about Tamagotchis and all these, you know, sort of interactive toys. The one point that she makes is that the difference between a teddy bear or a doll and a robot is that the robot kind of scripts the interaction with the child. Whereas when a child's playing with a doll or playing with a teddy bear, they're actually projecting certain things on the toy, and they're guiding the play, so to speak. And she talks about how this can kind of form, how this forms our self-perception of who we are, and adolescent psychology, and all the sort of stuff she pulls into it. So there is a difference between interacting with a thing that is scripted, so to speak, and a even if it responds, and a doll or a teddy bear.
I think that's a really good point. It is something fundamentally different because it is a two-way communication. Were you about to say something on that?
Yeah, I was just going to just add to what extent is it the responsibility of the creator of the algorithms, right?
Yeah.
That lay behind the robotic interaction, the virtual reality interaction, to ensure that it's a useful, ethical, moral interaction.
From I know you're not asking this, but from a legal perspective, I don't know. And I know that is currently a huge debate, especially with autonomous cars, has been a question. I think from a moral perspective, and especially a Christian perspective, the responsibility is always there from the perspective of the person creating it. That should always be in the forefront of their mind. How is this going to be a good fantasy, basically? How is this going to be a positive communication when it is a fantasy and not just a detrimental? So I would say yes, that's a huge responsibility for that person. Legally, I don't know what it would be, but yeah, from a Christian perspective.
Okay, maybe one more question. Beck?
So I'd be curious on your comments on, from a Christian perspective, do we have any moral obligation on how we treat the robots after they've been created? And also, what are your ideas on moral obligations once one enters a virtual reality realm?
Gotcha, yeah. I wish I had 20 minutes on this one. But
We don't have 20 minutes.
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned it a little bit, my perspective on how we treat robots morally, kind of from a robot perspective, comes from my understanding, my belief that robots don't have souls, are not sentient, are not created in the image of God, and don't have the human, human inalienable rights. At the same time, so I would think treating them morally is still important from the perspective of that fantasy I'm talking about. It's very important what it does is it shapes our understanding of the world and how we should behave. And so from that perspective, I would say we should still consider it extraordinarily important, and we should treat it in the same way, in many ways, how we treat other, animal abuse or human abuse, but for the sake of encouraging the good habituation and encouraging positive fantasy. As for VR, I'm going to try to quickly touch on that. Because of that primary reality I was talking about, I believe our how we act within virtual reality is just as significant as how we act in the physical world. I believe the mission "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations" still exists when we're in a virtual environment communicating with people, and harming someone within a virtual environment is just as serious if it's real harm to the individual. Killing someone in a virtual environment is different than killing someone in a physical environment, so that has to be taken into consideration. But we should nonetheless still carry our exact same morals into a VR.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
As many of you probably know, there are addictions now identified by psychologists that have to do with